how I did it. I got a license. I hired people and I growth hacked the shit out of it. Like, I literally published 14 hours a day, typos galore, like all over the place. And I just did publishing in digital in a way where no one had seen here before. We did transgender stuff, stuck in the airport, when Steven Gerrard was drunk dancing in the thing, when Bieber was in Brasti, when the Sheik walks into the restaurant. We were publishing like they didn't know what had happened. Time Out and What's On magazines and digital here were doing 10 posts on Facebook a week. We did 14 a day.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today is a really milestone moment. I told you we were going to go global and I've gone ahead and done it. This is the first in a series of podcasts you'll hear over the next month or so from the Middle East. Today is Richard Fitzgerald from Dubai. He is the founder of the Augustus Media Group. He is behind brands such as Love in Saudi, Love in Dubai. He's an investor and he's also the smartest person I've met when it comes to media and, more importantly, the future of media. Here is my chat with Richard. It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Nostra, an Irish IT company, offers world-class managed IT services, cloud solutions, IT support, and more, all tailored to meet your business needs. Whether you're streamlining operations or boosting productivity, their expert team is ready to help. Visit nostra.ie or email info@nostra.ie to see how they can solve your IT challenges today. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20. Elevate your marketing game today.
Richard, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. Good to see you in Dubai.
And most of all, thank you for hosting us.
You're welcome.
We're in your house.
You're in our house.
What a slick setup.
Our Augustus Coliseum, our office studios in Dubai Production City. Thank you. Good designers. We were here about 3 years. But yeah, it's nice to new people to see it. It's nice to use it. Yeah.
Something else, me and Ben, I was just telling Ben on the way, I was like, Ben, you're going to enjoy this place. It's like, we've been in a lot of places. we've shot in a lot of places. And it's just slick. It's just so well done. Where did this vision come from?
Well, Augustus, the name Augustus is a character in a period of history, and Emperor Augustus. And I think it's interesting, right? Mark Zuckerberg studied one thing in Harvard, Rome at the time of Augustus. He didn't even finish it. He didn't study Roman history. And I think there's something about what Emperor Augustus did. I remember in Irish history, we did Otto von Bismarck, and he united Germany. I just liked history. I just liked that idea. There's a few answers to this one, but Augustus, in theory, so when he came in, adopted kind of son of Julius Caesar, Rome was a mess, and he turned it from a republic into an empire. And that was sort of a few, you know, I think 17 BC or something like this, when he actually took over. And then after Christ and after he dies, like 70 years later, because he's only 18 or 20 when he took over Rome, then Rome had 200 years of peace. So we set our vision, our mission, Our mission, particularly, is to become the new media company of choice in the Middle East and North Africa. But our vision is bigger. It's to establish a new order in media and advertising globally. And that name and that person was of apt for that. We wrote that mission down, Gary, in 2015, when I bought the franchise of Love in Dublin. And it's dictated so much of the direction of the company. The other thing that Augustus did, if anyone's been to Rome and anywhere, you see political boards and you see sculptures and headshots and stuff like that. Augustus was the first person to put his headshot around the city. And you know, it's so fascinating. They actually did an exhibition in Hamburg in Germany in January last year. I traveled, when I found out about it, it was in the last week. I flew to Hamburg to see the exhibition. It was building some like images and power and mocked at the time of Augustus in Rome. And this institution was able to get all these marble stuff from everywhere because it's very known in this of curating, bringing things together. So I was like, unbelievable. And I saw the coins. He was very like how the sheikhs do now and how MBS in Saudi is doing the NEOM stuff. They would announce the new temple on a coin. In like 2025, they put the coin because they'd nowhere else to, they'd no social media or whatever.
Okay.
And that would inspire the people of Rome that there's going to be a big temple built in 4 years' time, you know?
That's cool.
And so he used coins and imagery to show
it. That's accessible to people at the time. Everyone had coins and everyone.
That's how he did it. And like, I have coins now from the exhibition, like with him on it and stuff like that. There's a few other brilliant stories. So that was the sort of like imaging and stuff like that. And now I think, like, I've been here so long now, I've been here 13 years. And now I think, why did I pick an Augustus name? Like, people don't know it about the Nabataeans. They're, you know, Petra and Jordan and that sort of stuff. They're sort of rewritten out of history. And then also the Umayyads and the Persian empires and things like that. Why did I pick a Western Augustus, like Rome is in our brains, but it's not in everyone's brains, you know? So that's Augustus. Another slight nod was, you know, my confirmation name, I picked Augustus, but actually Saint Augustine is the, I picked Augustus because my grandfather was known as Osti, and I thought that was his name. My mom told me that's his name, but he died in 1952 when she was two. But I picked it after him. And my brother's just been to Ireland and he's been going through the archives. My grandfather had a letter factory, Dickens Letter Factory, in Ireland in the 30s and 40s. He listed it on the Irish stock market. And there's photos of his brother with JFK and all that sort of stuff in America, bringing money back, all that stuff. So it's kind of like that aspirational thing of like, you know, my dad died when I was young as well. So that sort of thing of like creating something that's sort of a nod to that, but also something that's big enough to navigate all this media fragmentation that's going on. Well, that's the name.
Damn good answer.
But yeah.
And that's the podcast. Thank you, Sean.
That's the vision. And another thing I'll tell you about it is that.
But it means something to you. Like so often people pick names and you're just like, oh, we got off whiteboard. I'm like, eh.
Yeah.
It's nice when it has, because it's your life's work, right? Hopefully.
Yeah. You'd like to think so. But I mean, yeah, you know. Like also like, you know, don't get attached to anything that you can't walk away from a 30 seconds flat view. Do the heat around the corner.
There you go. Great reference.
You know,
God, we're getting all sorts of like pop culture, like Rome, Heat. Heat's a great movie.
Do you know, though, Gary, before I left Dublin in 2009, I was in London for a couple of years before the Olympics. And I remember going.
What were you doing? What's your background?
Social media. I joined Cybercom Huskies in Dublin in 2007. I went to Clongowes. I graduated in UCD with economics and German, 2002, 2006. And I got a job in outdoor advertising, selling six sheet stuff in newspaper. You know the boxes outside the newsagents that hold the newspapers?
Yeah.
Those ads with a company out in Bray. And then I did an evening diploma with a guy called Anthony Quigley in 2006 in Dublin, DIT.
He's marketing his food, isn't
it? Yeah. And I did well for the first time ever. And so I knew I liked this stuff because I kept reading about like digital agencies in London. I loved all this stuff back then. And Cybercom, Jonathan Forrest and Rob Reed gave me a job after like two or three interviews. And all of a sudden, in two or three years, I was doing digital marketing for Coca-Cola, banner ads, Lloyd's Bank. I know my group is UK, Doyle Collection. Like Cybercom Huskies had everything back then. They had all the banks. They had Diageo. We were doing flash banner ads, displays. I was doing paid media. I was doing everything, like Google ads, the first Facebook ads. I set up a social media Twitter account for Coca-Cola in Dublin called Coca-Cola Cities, and we gave away prizes before Coca-Cola had a global social media guidelines, before they paid us for it. We did it before, you know, and I was telling them, hey, guys, set up a social media division. And they're like, no, you get in trouble with your clients, Rich. You're not your dyslexia, but you make mistakes. I remember I used to do emails for Aer Lingus and I never checked them. And I always got the prices wrong. And they'd kill me.
Kind of important.
Because they were doing these blasts like 49 quid to Boston or whatever. And like, I always got it wrong. And like, they'd be like, I'm like, yeah, but like, I got 50 other things going on, you know? I remember having arguments over that. But anyway,
I'm like, you felt natural when you got in there, you kind of felt this is my calling, this is my thing.
I thought so, but I always clashed with my bosses. And like, there was two bosses in Dublin that, you know, didn't get on me, ever thought it was my fault. And then I went to London, clashed with my boss again. And I went to like a career psychologist or whatever, coach or whatever. And she's like, yeah, you're not really cut out for this. I'm like, but I know it all. Like, I'm good at it.
The career is in like social media or like just having a boss?
I think the advertising industry. I think that's what she was kind of saying. Yeah. Yeah.
So but, it sounds like you just didn't need a boss. That's what my wife said to me. She goes, you could never have a boss. Like, I mean, no, I know. I was just not wired that way. I'm just not.
Yeah.
Like the freedom is just worth anything to me. It's worth any figure you can put on it. Yeah. It sounds like that's what you need, is someone to go, Richard, just set up your own thing.
Well, maybe, but the next company I went to cared more about like careers, and you know, they were a big agency in London with 400 people, and they were like best places to work, and they hired external coaches that taught us conflict resolution, NLP, and my bosses were great, and I got promoted for the first time ever, and it taught me, like,
did that help you, the coaching?
Yeah, there's definitely management stuff. I remember going into these things saying, this is how you deal with difficult people, because I read it in football biographies and manager biographies. And they're like, no, don't kick a boot in someone's head.
Fergie wasn't right to hit Beckham with the boot. You know, that's not how we do it here. Yeah, I read all those books as well.
But you can learn from anywhere, though. You can learn, but yeah, it's the style, isn't it?
You can, but I think, you know, going back to that sort of boarding school thing and stuff like that, is that like, You conflict a bit, and then you sort of learn how to manage upwards and learn how to work. And so, you know, I was 32 when I left this industry and set up my own, but I always treat myself as an employee. I don't think of myself as an entrepreneur. And
even now?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It kind of surprises me how often I hear that. Why?
I have a salary, I have responsibility, and I don't want to act like an entrepreneur. I don't want to think like exiting. I don't want to think like fundraising. I don't want to think like pivoting. I can be an intrapreneur. I created a social media department for Mindshare in Middle East and North Africa. I hired 40 trilingual graduates in Beirut. And I created a social media department from 2012 to 2015. Profitable. CFO loved it. The reason I ever left any company is because they weren't as ambitious as me. You know, like Cybercom wouldn't open a social media department. So I went to We Are Social, which became the biggest social media agency in the world in London. When I went to MEC, part of that Mindshare Group M thingy, the reason I left was because they wouldn't make me social media direct. My bosses were, I was 28, they were 44, and they were great, but they wouldn't promote me fast enough. So I got social media director job here. And then they wouldn't create a branded content department or an influencer department. So it's like, I'll go and do it somewhere else.
This sounds like you just were born to be an entrepreneur.
Maybe.
I know you don't call yourself, but everything you're describing, like the speed you want to execute at, the vision you have, like the action you want to take, like the urgency is dripping out of you.
Yeah, I think, but you can be intrapreneur. I don't think entrepreneurs can't do well in a corporate world as well, right? I want to list a company. I want to, you know, we share all our numbers. Like I'm not trying to flip things. Like I invest, I have a FTSE fund on the side, but I'm trying to build something.
FTSE fund.
Over time. I saw that linked it. I was like, I like that.
The new Augustus. So what brought you out here, I guess? Well, you were in London, you worked in social. What was here the next move?
Not necessarily, Gary. Like I had long hair. I was living in Shoreditch. I have a fixed gear bike back then. I liked London. I moved to London to be involved in a city, and it was leading up to Olympics. And I thought it's going to turn a difference, you know. But I left a month before the Olympics. I missed the whole crack.
Why'd you leave?
Because I got offered a job as social media director in Dubai. And it was on double salary and tax-free.
Oh, wow.
I think I got up to, I wasn't paid well in those years. I started in Dublin on 23,000 euro and when people, you know, in 2006, I moved to London. I took a pay cut to go to London when everyone was staying during that recession. I went on 20,000 sterling in London when I was 25. I got up to like 28 when I went to MEC, and then 33,000 sterling. And here they offered me, I think like between 2012 and 2015, like I was taking in $10,000 a month tax-free.
Wow.
Then, if not more at the end. Like they promoted me fast. I became social media director, then regional social media director. I was porting into 12 MDs across the region and CEO. And that was that. And then, but the other reason was like, it was exciting, you know, especially when I landed.
Had you been here before?
No, I flew through Abu Dhabi once, so I'd never been here.
And you just rocked up.
I rocked up. It was.
Did you take the job before? Did you come out for an interview, or did you take the job before you came out?
Took the job. They wanted me. I was in London in April, and signed it. They wanted me in a month, and I was like, "Look, I'll come on 2nd in June." I landed on the Friday, and back then the weekends were Friday, Saturday. I walked into the office on the 3rd of June, 2012, and I stayed in the hotel for a month, and for 100 days I didn't leave the office. And I did 33 pitches in 100 days. And I basically built a social media department out of nothing. I was so determined, because when I moved from Dublin to London, I lost my job in 7 months. I bought a bike and went to every football game, every art gallery. And I was like, I'm not making this mistake again. So I was coming over here. I got all those 100-day books. And I was like, I did interviews with everyone across the... I was speaking to MDs in Iraq, in North Africa, in Tunis. I was like,
What was your goal? 100 days, what do you want to achieve?
Set up a social media department, get business, build a revenue stream. I wanted to prove that you could make a business out of social media community management. In MEC in London, they were giving it away for free. They were making so much money from buying TV ads and outdoor.
Okay.
They were doing social as out of value. And I wanted to do the unit economics and the margins on community management. Like, paid ads were coming, but wasn't really there. Like, that whole Facebook thing was only really kicking in. And they were about 4 years behind, like, we are social. We're setting up a social media department in 2012, you know?
I was wild to think, that's not long ago.
No.
Like, this is really interesting to get into this with you, because, like, it's such an evolving space. Like, that's not that long ago to think that this wasn't really a thing.
We were the first agency in the world to set up a Facebook page for HSBC. And it took 3 years to do it because of the sanctions, Syria and all this sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The compliance was mad. But like other things, we'd set up like Nissan Middle East, like we'd set up all that stuff. They didn't have Instagram. They didn't have Facebook, like barely. So that was the goal, to establish that. And, you know, at the end of that, I was sort of a little bit restless. But when I was here in those years, I didn't really see Dubai. Like, I was in Beirut, in Saudi, in Egypt, I was in Jordan, I was around.
So your job was all over the region. So you came into Dubai, but your job was to build a social department for the whole region.
They had 12 countries, yeah.
Right.
They had 12 or 13 offices covering what we call MENA, Middle East, North Africa. It was interesting later years with Emin O'Neill from Kuchin and those guys who bought Love in Dublin, trying to negotiate with them about this region. You know, when I was signing what we call the license IP and assignment to buy the Love in brand off them, I was trying to tell them that, like, you know, Morocco is ours. And they're like, we go on holiday there. Sorry. It's kind of more Europe, you know? I was like, no, but...
It's really this what it is, right? Surely it's covered under like some sort of like... Like, yeah, really, it's defined.
Well, I mean, not just them, but like, is it defined? Like, is Turkey, like, because people say MENA with T, with Turkey, and different, you know, different global brands break up the regions in different ways.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, like, I thought it was a standard thing. Okay.
Not necessarily. Like, some people do this region out of Europe.
Yeah.
EMEA, you ever hear those titles?
Yeah.
So that's Europe, Middle East, and Africa. But some other people might do it out of Singapore and Asia. You know, and we didn't get Turkey in our little bundle of 16 countries. I was going for, you know, like 22, because that's what Augustus will do, inshallah. Like, that's what we're trying to do. But after the 3 years of doing social media for Mindshare, I was restless.
Sounds like you... just a restless as a person. It sounds like you were just like, we've covered so much. We're like, what, 15 minutes in. So at what point then did you think, right, I'm going to do this for myself?
over the years, I would meet with people and I would say, hey, you'll be my partner. We'll set up a social media agency. And I thought you had to have some fresh idea to set up a social media agency. I was thinking real time agency and things like that. And I never set it up. And I would get restless at night and stuff like that. Like, you know, self-actualization, like, am I doing the right thing or whatever? Equally, I was thinking, am I career climbing at WPP? Will I get to know Sir Martin Sorrell more and blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. So am I going the corporate ladder or will I go and do something? So I didn't really know. And I remember flying back from Beirut. I just flew down. I had to deal with some stuff. I had to fire someone actually on that trip. And I remember being back on the flight, writing as a business plan, as a pitch to a guy who had a tech bot app, who was one of our clients here. So we used to run like Twitter campaigns for Nissan Infiniti, and they would do the auto trigger reply as like a design image to the users or whatever. And they were building that software. So he'd raised some cash and I pitched him to be MD and he gave me the job, right? And I had 3 months to get out of that. Not, they didn't put me on gardening leave, but I had to spend 3 months working in the summer of 2015. And at the same time, I messaged Niall Harbison in Dublin, who'd been doing Love in Dublin for about 2012. I go, Niall, this is cool. What are you doing with it? And he goes, funny you say it. I just met with our MD and we're going to do a franchise thing. I'm like, cool. So, like ChatGPT wasn't around at the time, but cobbled together a 10-year area developer agreement. And so in September, I'm wearing two hats. I'm MD of Brandster. It was called a social tech software that since went bust or shut down or whatever. And then I'm also the owner of Love in Dubai, which hadn't launched. And I registered Augustus Media. I hired an editor from a big magazine here, like Stylist, like ITP, all that stuff. And I hired one social salesperson. And I had 20 grand. My brother gave me 20 grand. And a few months in, it wasn't making money. And I was stressed out because I was MD trying to grow a startup at weekends trying to do
both. Bring me back though. You'd spotted Love in Dublin bubbling up at the time, had you?
Yeah.
You'd kind of keep an eye on the scene at home and you were like, why did you go the licensing route as opposed to setting something up yourself?
I don't know. I think, you know, back then, like podcasting, like TikTok, back then blogging was really big, like 2010, 2012. But every blog looked like a blog.
Yeah.
Love in Dublin didn't look like a blog. It looked like a media company. And it's really hard to nail it.
Yeah.
And
it's part art, part science, part like magic. I think about it. I obsess about this all the time.
It's true. I like how you do that with your finger, people who got listening, but like it is, it's like a lovely restaurant or whatever. And when you see something that has that, je ne sais quoi, or whatever.
It's like when you walk into a beautiful hotel, I always love hotel lobbies. I walk in and I'm like, yeah, it's really luxury, but you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
That magic feeling. Exactly. That when I see a beautiful brand or something, like, that's the feeling.
Yeah. And you go, oh, I'll do that. And you go, no, it's hard. Mm. So we paid for that. And we paid, I think we were paying like 20 or 40 grand a year eventually. And it became a crux because it wasn't worth it for places like Egypt. Because no one knew Lovin here.
That's why I was curious to ask you why you went that route. Because, you know, it's not like you were buying a Coke franchise to distribute in the Middle East. It was quite, he smashed it in Ireland. Like Lovin was everywhere. That was the only thing people read all day. So Niall, in fairness, smashed it. Like, he created that. But I mean, down here, it wouldn't...
No, no one knew it. And also media isn't necessarily like McDonald's, like what size straw to use and stuff like that. So it's not a natural franchise, although they pay it like Vogue and all that, like they pay a franchise fee. But we needed to localize it. So I paid that and they were giving me the tech. They had one guy, they were giving me the tech. So it meant, it was just, you know, as a startup, it's just one less thing to worry about.
Exactly, yeah.
So I had the tech, I had the brand. I had a brand that no one knew, right? But I had to build the brand, the Love in Dubai brand. And that's why I choose that. Like, and it's like startup. It's just one less thing to worry about at the start. But I had no business. And from month one, we nailed it. Like I was doing a blog in London, 52 burrito days, it's a whole other story. But I was doing like 5,000 page views a month. Like one,
two burrito days.
Yeah. Yeah. I won a supply. I basically dated a different girl every week for a year. And it became really big in London at the time, like BBC, the Metro, all that stuff. I won it at Chilango, a burrito chain in London, at a Twitter festival in 2010. And I did it in the evenings. And I just, they requested a burrito date. And I dated a different girl every week and wrote about it.
That is wild.
Still on.
Still
on?
You're still on. I'm going to read that. That sounds like a good read. So like, you've clearly had this idea, this restlessness. So then, Love in Dubai, what was your vision? like, what was your plan? Because I think, and I ask this every single time, and I labor on this point on the pod, and I make a point of calling it out every single time, the zero to one. Because I want one person listening to start a business out for listening to you and the next guest, creates this wave of new entrepreneurs. So the zero to one piece, explain why you did it. Like, what was the process of going from zero to one? You bought the franchise, and then what?
I think I wanted to set up a social media agency or social media thing, and this became it.
Right.
And instead of being an agency, it became a media company.
Mm.
And I was just restless to do something, and that was it. How I did it, I got a license, I hired people, and I growth hacked the shit out of it. Like, I literally published 14 hours a day, typos galore, like all over the place. And I just did publishing in digital in a way where no one had seen here before. We did transgender stuff, stuck in airports, when Steven Gerrard was drunk dancing in the thing, when Bieber was in Barasti. When the Sheik walks into the restaurant, we were publishing like they didn't know what had happened. We just published, Time Out and What's On magazines and digital here, we're doing 10 posts on Facebook a week. We did 14 a day from day one.
You just hit it with volume.
Yeah.
You were like, we were going to hit this with such volume.
I was so obsessed, relentless with it. Like, I remember, like, I had to rent out a spare room in my apartment. I didn't know cash. Like, talk about the money thing. A year into it, we had no clients. And I was like, this is going to be easy. I'll just sell to the agencies. But even though we built an audience, they didn't buy it.
Why?
I think you need to, with publishing, you need to build credibility first.
Okay.
And audience isn't enough, per se, for the big brands.
Which is wild, considering your background. It's not like you're coming out the screen.
You know, no.
You'd been on the other side of the fence. That's why I was so interested to see, oh, you probably had all the clients. You just turned it on.
I had all the I was so sure of it. I was so sure if I have an audience, I'll be able to sell. Yeah. And I couldn't. And then I had to start selling equity. And that's where it got dicey, because I was giving away 5% and 10% for like $40,000. I still have 75% in the first year. And then we rolled them all up to the parent group now. We're now in 22 countries. Lovin's in 22 cities, sorry. We're in 11 countries. And we have a streaming service, and we have Odeon and an agency. You know, we have 110 employees. We did $12 million in gross revenue last year. This year we'll do 15.
Is that dirham or your
dollars?
Dollars.
Yeah. And except the pandemic year, we do 20-25% EBIT every year. Dividends, reinvest, grow. We have 50 people in Egypt.
50.
20 in Saudi. First foreign-owned company in Saudi Arabia. I fully own it. Media license, regulators, like mad stories would tell you.
So 2016 to 2005. That's a big...
Yeah.
We've got a lot to cover.
Yeah, 2015.
We've got a lot to get through here.
Yeah, yeah. I'll go fast.
Bring me, well, I think that's your nature, but like, we've lost time. Bring me back though to 2016. So year one, tough, grinding out. You were just relentlessly volume, volume, volume. When did you get your first client?
I think, good question, because my first client wasn't on Love in Dubai. My first client was a social media retainer. 50,000 dirhams, about $10,000, $12,000 a month, because that's what I knew. So I went back to pitching Infinity Middle East, which is part of the Nissan group. And I had a few malls here, and I hired social media execs separate. So I was doing two things. I was like, I broke out of the MD thing by 1st of May 2016, because Love in Dubai has 250,000 page views or whatever. And then by the end of 2016, when I was doing editor full time, I started selling restaurant packages for about $2,000 over a few months. Articles. We did a lot of sponsored articles back then.
Okay.
Like 3,000 page views for, you know, $1,000 or whatever. Did a lot of sponsored articles. That was our main branded content unit. Before now, we're in Reels and TikToks and videos and lives and Instagram stories, takeovers and stuff. But back then, our native unit was articles onto Facebook. Facebook, we were huge. We got to 1 million fans on Facebook quite quickly. We're now at 1.8, obviously it tailored off a bit. But one of the other tricks then was, end of 2016, I'm selling to restaurants, F&B, getting into that budget that they're paying PR agency, but getting the guaranteed coverage thing. We were always guaranteed the page views. So we wouldn't say coverage. We'd say, here's your article, here's your link, pre-approve it, publish it. So here we didn't do reviews. Love in Dublin did, we didn't.
What did you do?
We did clickbait stuff. We did curated viral stuff. an influencer does this, someone falls, someone says this. We call them rip shares videos, like Lab Bible. Like we would just take videos, brand it, tell a bit more story and just put it up.
Give a context. But even in 2025, that's now huge again.
We still do that.
The old is new. Like yeah. this whole thing of like, you'll never guess what Richard did. He was on Gary's podcast, blah, blah, blah. Here it is. Like, it's just, what's old is new. The curation thing on TikTok is very interesting.
So true. Yeah. Yeah. And that was the model. That was the fast type of thing. That was the content. Plus real news, like real news, like breaking government stuff. Like during the pandemic, like people wanted to know what's going on. And like, there's a lot of immigrants who move here and people want to know what's going on. So like, and they became to rely on Love in Dubai. They trusted us. We were first. We were fast. We had 15 minute approval rules. Like we try and get stuff out. You put a headline in. If no one disagrees with it, you then put a link in. If no one disagrees with it, it goes out. 15-minute rules.
Okay.
And
the journalists that put in the story go to an editor or someone to approve. Bang.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't get approval, it goes up. And you have to teach the editor, you have to teach the writers to curate, to pick, to package, to distribute. And you empower them to do all that. And you protect them. And you... You try and let the, this is why we don't hire freelancers. Like we need people to retain the knowledge of what's going to trigger people, what's going to upset people, what's the comments, what's legal, what's defamation, all that stuff.
That's a good insight actually, because I was actually wondering, so you staff people, so then they build up that knowledge bank of going, this is the loving way.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you grow? So bring me back to like where you hired your first couple of people. How did you grow then to like, obviously you've grown exponentially, but like how did you grow the first couple of years?
There was one thing that we did. There was a newspaper here called 7 Days, a bit like, what was the one in Dublin? Metro?
Metro, yeah.
These sites.
It was a thing, yeah. There's two of them, yeah.
Our Daily Mail or whatever. And they were free in all the buildings. Like, you know, if you live in Dubai, you usually might rent in a high tower. You go down in the morning. If you're not driving, you pick up what was called a Metro newspaper and you hop in your cab and you flick through a tabloid, right? They shut down and to do with licensing or... that shift to print as well from digital, they weren't on it. And I contacted the CEO and I'm like, I'll buy your Twitter account. And he's like, and in the end, I don't think he really knew. He's like, here are the logins for our Facebook or Twitter. Because I dealt with so many issues of Facebook not letting us change names. Like I remember Henkel, like Wilkinson Sword, they just wouldn't let us change names. So I'm like, I'm never going to be able to change the name of the Instagram page and the Facebook page of 7 Days UAE. So I didn't offer him for that. And in the end, he goes, 20 grand, it's a load of money to us back then. Load of money.
What are we going to do with them?
Merge them with Love in Dubai.
But you were going to try change the name
to
Love in Dubai? Okay.
And I still remember, it was beautiful. I was playing five-a-side football one night and 7 Days UAE had 600,000 Facebook fans with 200. And they had 40,000 Instagram followers.
So you're able to put the page together, really?
Do you know how it did it? This is 2017. I got a letter from the CEO of 7 Days saying, we're shutting down. People in the UAE subscribe to our page to receive news. They no longer receive local news. I endorse Love in Dubai to provide local news to our followers. And Facebook, at the time in Dublin, and I saw the fans totting up every hour. It wasn't one slick. It was over a 12-hour period overnight. I woke up the next day and we had 800,000 Facebook fans from 200. We had 60,000 Instagram followers. We're now 1.4 million, but on Love in Dubai alone, like I think like 15 million overall, but we had 20,000, right? And then I got Katie Harvey, who runs a comms agency here, asked her for a favor. She pushed this out as PR everywhere.
How did you spin it?
Love in Dubai acquires 7 Days social media assets. And everyone read this and go like, oh my God, how did they do that?
And then so as someone who's trying to grow like social accounts and stuff, that's genius.
But you know what happened, right? We went from 700,000 page views. Like this was a year and a half of growth hacking. And they were at about 500. And we didn't buy their SEO domain. We bought the social profiles. So we went from 700,000 page views in December 2016. We crossed into 1 million because of this in Jan. By June 2017... we did 2.9 million page views. We did 23 articles on the 5th of June during the Qatar blockade, a big story in the region. And then another viral article, Rihanna was dating some Saudi guy. And we got 2.9 million page views that month, all on the back of that sort of extra social followers. And so
you credit being able to transfer them across from social, you were able to directly see brought this in and you were able to directly see the page views?
It was for Facebook. It was Facebook, yeah.
Really?
And then that kicked on the brand, and that gave us, going back to the credibility part, you know, like Niall had, you know, rugby captain as his chief friend. Like, he got credibility earlier by doing tricks. Like, how do you get credibility as a brand? How do you get the big guest on? How do you do this? Like, what is credibility? And I think what people think is they see one thing, and they think it's the same elsewhere. There was no rugby captain in UAE. I tried to get an influencer. She almost had 10% of the business, and I realized I didn't need it. My credibility was buying 7 days. That made me a newspaper, you know,
framed probably in people's heads what you were. You're like, oh, it's not just this. It's, that's genius.
It worked. And I always look for credibility. I'll always look for, you know, what gives it? Is it a big guest? Is it marketing? Is it buying a billboard? Is it something, you know, you need behavior, you need people to wake up in the morning and go, what did Love and Buy say about that? You know, and you need to do that as well. And that's from product, but that's from like your having people online at the right time, knowing how to do the right story. Like, I remember this plane crashes, like there was an Emirates plane crash, and we had 500,000 page views from one article because we were number one on Reddit and in the US. It was all external traffic, but like just having the team to know how to publish, to use the word safely disembarked, that Emirates Corp comms team were so aggressive on, instead of like evacuated plane crash. Right. You know, like, so it's all these words, it's all this comms stuff.
Nuance. Mm. Is it tricky to operate in the Middle East, as in restrictions?
Yeah, I love this question, and I hate it for a foreign audience, because the West will never get it. You know, that we're brought up, even in Ireland, in media world, related to the First Amendment of a constitution for a country of a few hundred million people in the 18th century. Like, we think of freedom of speech as media. That's what we think. And we don't understand anything else. So I don't want to, that's why I stay here, because I don't want to explain anything else. But I see the benefits of an Islam-related media environment. I see the benefits of it. I see no phone hacking. I see no Caroline Flack committing suicide because of media stuff. I see no Princess Diana paparazzi stuff. I see none of this stuff here, right? And people will say different stuff, but I like it. And we have simple rules. No prophet, peace be upon him. No leadership, and no defamation. So don't go out there and say Gary's bad his job. Who am I to deprive you the chance of earning a living? So we don't do it.
Okay. That's really interesting. So I think traditional media is in deep, deep trouble. Like, after COVID, traditional media trust is gone.
It's gone. It actually, like, it's over, isn't it?
Like, it was tumbling for a very long time. It was tumbling. That's when I came here yesterday. I was like, this is the future of media. I literally walked in, got on the phone last night to Ben. I was like, wait till see tomorrow. Are you going to see the future of media? Because, like, me and Ben talk about this all the time. Because, like, we've been doing this for, like, 6 years now. And you're always trying to evolve and kind of going, I think this is it.
I think what you guys are doing is the future of media.
But it's both, right? It's these things together. And it's us doing social. It's us doing the clips. The clips, this will go out. The clips might do a couple of million views. That's insane. Like, we did, 12, 13 million views last year in social. Like, that's a lot for one person. I've got a team around me. But, like, when you think of that reach, but then I look at traditional media and look at, like, RTE, Irish Times, like, it's gone. Like, it's going, gone. Like, after COVID, it was just like, bang. Just people, like, don't trust anything RTE says. They don't trust anything Irish Times says, which is a problem.
It's a trust problem. It's also a business model problem.
The traditional media problem has been going for a long time. Like, they just can't figure out how to make money, and the switch to digital hasn't worked for them. Some of them have kind of done it okay. There's only a few, like, the Financial Times, you kind of go, yeah, that's the only one you kind of trust and go, yeah, they're actually, everyone's got an angle. And now everyone in the public knows this. Everyone knows there's an angle. They know there's, like, censorship of some form or another.
And I think that's going to your last question about, is it hard here? I think media needs to be upfront about their angle.
Yeah.
Like, it's in the name. It doesn't rub eye. Like, we're positive about where we're from. And when we hire journalists in Baghdad or Gaza or Cairo, we want them to defend that city. Right. And same with like Smashy Business wants to be the young person's Bloomberg. It's the tagline is for the driven, the dreamers, the doers. Like, the angle is there. I call it a media lens. We're not impartial. We're pro. Like, we're positive. Like, we had a journalist here once who wanted to do all the sort of like investigative journalists about business. I'm like, cool, there's a place for it.
There is.
There's a place for it. And there's also a place for it on Smashy. But actually, if someone raises money or someone tells the story on your entrepreneur podcast, we're going to celebrate that. Like, what's wrong with inspiring stories, you know?
And that's all this podcast is. I am pro founder. That's what I say to people. I'm like, no prep needed. It's your story. And I am pro. I do not go after people. I do not clip things to make people look bad. This is pro business. This is to support, celebrate you, but also, as I said earlier, to inspire one person to start something. There's enough negativity in the world. And there's enough people going after people. I don't want any part of that. Zero. I don't want to spend my life doing things like that. I want to be a net positive to the world. And like, I think there's a lot of place for that. You interpret it how you want. You make your own, you get your media from here, here, and here. You make a judgment on that. But there's enough people with negativity in the world. People biased towards negativity because it sells. Media has biased towards negativity in the complete wrong direction. Mm. Now everything's negative.
That's true. And there you said it, like, it's okay to have an angle. You know, the new media.
You have to stand for something. Like, we're obviously very similar. Stand for positivity, pro-business. Like, you have to have an angle and understand that this is your audience. You can't be for everybody. If you're everybody, you're for vanilla. And that's the problem with old media, is that they were used to be for everybody. Everyone used to get the same news in the same outlet. Now you get your phone out. Any bit of information in the world is available to you now.
I think the problem is, like, if you think of here, they have media offices in all the Emirates, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and they have social media accounts. So that's like RT or whatever, like that's the news, right? And you have a thing called WAM, which is the National News Agency. That can be vanilla, that can be news. But when it's state-sponsored, like RT is or whatever, it can be news, you know? But their challenge is, like, how do you have an angle? Like, BBC is challenged as well for the same reason. In this part of the world, they think BBC has always been biased, you know? But yeah, everyone has different views on different news organizations.
It's fascinating because media is still, like we were talking about before we came on air, like media is just, it's up in the air. It's there for grabs, I think. Like, you guys are innovating in a lot of different ways, but like, just feels that there's a tipping point now. It feels like there's something else happening, that these new model is coming, because it's taken a long time, right? So bring me back then to like 2017, 2018, it's starting to grow. You've kind of hacked your way to like a couple of million page views. Was there a moment where you're like, oh, this is going to work? I think you seem like the kind of guy who knew it was going to work from the start, but was there a moment where you're like, I think we're on something here?
You know, since day one, we run the business in the same way. I have the same three board of directors. They get an email on the 8th of the month with the P&L. We have...
Where did they come from?
One from Syria, one from Jordan, and one is my brother William in San Francisco. But they're basically through old... The first two were through work I used to work here. People I knew through the industry, they invested. So they're kind of like investors, as opposed to, you know, they get dividends every year, they look after their investment, but they allow me to have that, is it due diligence or that governance? They give me that governance. I haven't missed a board meeting. I haven't missed a board report in 10 years. Like, I don't miss them. Like, I do four every year. They get their annual report. We do audits and all that sort of stuff. Even as we grow, like we have to do audits in all these countries. We have so much compliance. We have in-house legal counsel in Egypt. We're getting bigger and bigger, you know. We want to be in Afghanistan. We have a license in Pakistan. All this sort of stuff, right? So, you know, what else do we do on the reporting side of things? Every month I send the first report to all our staff. So everything grows incrementally. Like I was managing a social media team in Mindshare or whatever. If I have three people in my team, I will manage those team and I will communicate to them. When I started here, I was started with emailing three people, then five, then 10. And we went from a co-working space with three laptops. I remember leaving Brandster and going into Astrolabs and thinking, oh, now I need to look big here. So I'll pay for the desks at the back, right? And I think like the desks at the back were $100 more than the free desks. People in co-working spaces will know this stuff. And I couldn't afford it after 2 months. I have to, with my head in hands, walk back into the cheap seats, right?
To the front.
Yeah, back to the front. And but I was like, okay, after five visas, I have to get out of here because they only cap you at five. I remember driving around JLT, people know Dubai, and looking at the towers going, when can we afford one of those offices? So when we were five people, we had to move into a space that we could grow to eight people. Then we got an office in 2017. And by 2019, we moved into a place that had 20 people. And then eventually we moved in here. But at the time, we opened office in Saudi and all that sort of stuff. But going back to the question, so like I didn't, there was that tipping point, but in 2017, we were profitable. So 2016, that year I moved in on the first, 2017, we were profitable and we started paying dividend. And it was just incremental from there. Like I published the stats, like it goes from $1 million to 2 million to 3 to 4 to 5 every year, 20, 30% growth on average every year. And we just make decisions along the way. Like we just, it's almost like a board game of Risk where you're like putting people into each country, pulling back. This is the base, protect the base. Opened in Abu Dhabi last year, actually a year and a half ago, and we did $500,000, a bit more overall. Actually, close to $800,000 or $900,000 gross if we do rev share or transfer pricing. A lot of that is from Dubai, but we have four people in an office in Abu Dhabi. Now I'm opening a branch in Ras Al Khaimah where the gaming, what do you call them, gambling casinos are opening. Yeah. So step by step, all the way. But I don't think even now I'm not getting complacent. Like we're it's been disrupted all the time by AI, by creators and everything. Like I know that we have a revenue number, but equally our number isn't interesting to most people. Our $12-15 million, private equity don't look at that, you know? So
funny, you know, built such a big business employing so many people, but like, yeah, they don't. They always look like the, what's the 100x?
What's going to get to a billion?
What's going to get to a billion? And what's $25 or $30 million revenue? And like, you know, and then they'll value you. We've had valuations over the years. I remember one year someone offered us $3 million for the business and we were doing 3 million. I was like, what? And then the next time someone offered, on a 12 million year, someone offered us 12 million, but they were kind of going to offer us 6, of which they would pay 3. And then use your profits over the next few years.
Yeah, big in America, yeah. Seller financing.
Yeah, like leverage buyout, whatever. And like, and then they would get to 51 and kick you out in 3 years. I'm kind of like, but we're doing 12 and we'll do 15 next year. You know, like if people want to offer 40, then that's okay.
That's a different, yeah, now, multiple, like 4 or 5, 10x, whatever it is. There has to be multiple. It can't be just for like your revenue. You're like, I can just do nothing and still make the same money. Whereas you're a driven guy, you've got like the playbook now.
And also we bought out of the franchise. So we own the IP here. We own Smashy. We own everything.
Okay.
So we don't.
When did you buy out?
January 2020. Interesting time.
Very interesting time. But good or bad?
Good. It was cheap. It was value. They had decided that media wasn't for them. Really nice guys. And they kind of tried everything. They tried to merge us back into Dublin. They sort of wanted to sell off the assets and then sell. And eventually they sold to Greencastle Media and Love in Dublin is still going. But we paid what would have been our royalties for that year to get out of the royalty thing. And it would have become quite costly for us. After 5 years, we would have had to pay 5% of gross. And that would have become quite costly because we're building up to a couple million, you know. And each city, the reason we didn't expand so fast is because each city, instead of $20,000 in the agreement that I signed, a 5 year into a 10 year agreement would have been $40,000.
Oh wow!
So if I opened in the 22 cities, I would have had 22 by 40 plus 5% of gross, and then in 10 years they could have flipped it to someone else.
Okay.
So
that made no sense.
Yeah, and the, you know, to be fair, like they didn't really buy the IP in the region. They didn't protect us. There was so much stuff that we were open because they didn't grow the brand. Niall had left and they didn't grow internationally in the way. So we were kind of going, hang on, like we're open here. Someone can just register Lovin in Saudi or whatever.
Okay. So, right. So you were exposed.
Yeah. And we needed to invest. We needed to invest in the brand. We needed to do all that sort of stuff. So it was an amicable deal. And then it allowed us to set up a load of Facebook pages, a load of Instagram pages, which have now grown really big just by having the freedom to, and we changed the brand a little bit. You'll see the Arabic under Lovin. We kept the same style of everything. So we bought out of that and it was a really good deal. It was a really good move.
And then you've expanded like crazy.
Yeah.
How have you done that?
Bit by bit. We tried at the time we put up a incorporated JV partnership thing. We thought we'd find someone like us. And we thought we'd flip the model that made it hard for us. So we'll go, we won't charge you a franchise fee. We'll give it for free, but let us own, you do all the work and we'll own minority 40%
good
of
idea.
The business.
I like
good,
that.
Good idea. Paper didn't work. We tried it.
Why?
Wrong partners. And in the end, you have to do it yourself. In the end, you have to put the money in anyway. People do it differently, but we decided to do it ourselves. So with Egypt and now, like, you know, in Levant region, so Levant here is Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Iraq really, and Lebanon, right? So around there is known as the Levant or Al-Shams. So we don't have an office there, but we've two journalists in Gaza, one, I said, in Baghdad, one in Beirut, two in Amman, and we're doing Syria now, that hopefully, inshallah, the sanctions get removed. So that area is remote for us, right? Everywhere else we have an office per se, and we have full-time employees. And by an office, like, people say, why do you have an office? It's not necessarily an office. It's more like you have a bank account, you have a media license. You know, people will try and do remote working stuff, and you can. You can do drop shipping, and you can do all that sort of stuff. But to be the biggest media company in Syria or Cairo, I can't do that from here. I can have Love in Cairo as the biggest account from here with remote workers, but I can't be known on the ground. I can't stand up when I'm getting legal suits because I don't have a license. Right. So going back to the credibility and the legitimacy, and this is the thing I don't think people can value, like going back to the Augustus thing, the train tracks, building the infrastructure across the region. No one has the licenses we have. And I can say that
you're now protected, because in media, the killer is you're only as good as your last podcast. Because I was explaining the model to someone yesterday. He was an investor and he's like, explain podcast. How does it work? I was like, it's good and bad. You know, it grows and I'm in charge of it. But also, if I stop, it stops. You know, when I was saying, like, my moat is really just myself going out and doing it every single month. But, like, you've now built a moat.
We have a regulatory moat. Like, in Saudi, when we had a regulatory issue and we solved it, I realized it's good that they've renewed our license and they're watching us. They're checking the comments. Did we allow that? Did they not? And, like, for 5 years, there was nothing. And now that they gave us a slap in the wrist and go, hey, and we're like, cool, tell us what to do, hardest editor, do this.
Where's the line? Yeah.
Yeah. And even people from the region go, Rich, how do you get that extra license? It's called GAMR in Saudi. It was called GCAM. How do you get it? And now we have it. We have to, obviously have to protect it every year, but we've got this moat now. We've got this regulatory moat, and we want to continue to have that.
How have you learned, Rich? Like, how have you learned each model to go into different countries? Because I'd imagine there's a nuance, you know, I bet Abu's different than here. Saudi's different than here. Like, how have you learned this?
By failing, like, or honestly, like, I've changed colors and logos in Saudi 3-4 times, like, languages. I just believe in the product can work locally. People say every idea, Love and Works because it's expats. No, it works in Cairo, but Cairo is different to, because they call it ABC class, like class A speaks English and others. So we do a bit of both there. In Saudi, we have Love in Saudi and Green Bilarabi in Arabic, and then we have Love in Riyadh in English. And we do the red ones all around the kingdom, like Alula, Jeddah, Sharjah, all these ones. And it's maybe not perfect, but it's working. But it's 7 years and it's still like it's 1/8 of the size of UAE business. So market entry, any entrepreneur, market entry is probably the hardest thing, because you think you've cracked it, a restaurant, a brand. Like, it's the hardest thing to get right.
I hear it all the time, but I hear it from Irish entrepreneurs going to England. So, like, for you to go to all these different countries with so many different nuances, people have said it to me, like Philip from Therapy was like, you know, Gary, Glasgow's different to Leeds, Leeds different to Manchester, and Manchester's a hell of a lot different than London. So, like, if they're, you know, struggling to go across like a 60-minute flight, how, you've said by failing, like, but it's ambitious, like. You really seem to be very, very ambitious to grow the brand as hard and as fast as you can.
Yeah, I don't know about hard and fast. I don't think it's zero sum. I actually see it as 30, 40, 50 years. I have a long-term view on it.
Okay,
yeah.
Interesting.
But maybe over that time, you still need to go hard and fast. You probably do. Like, but other things that we've learned is it's local, so it has to be local. We need people who know the city, love the city. But there is a playbook. Like, there's... you know, how do you do Love in Dubai and Love in Ireland? Like, feck our string girls thing, right? That doesn't work here, right? You know, but there are things that nostalgia works, national brands, national heroes, people work, and that type of stuff. Like, there's a crown prince in Dubai is super popular. There's a crown prince in Saudi is super popular. Yeah. There are actors and celebs in Egypt who are super popular. There's national airline carriers here, there. There's nostalgia. If I tell you, you know, what was the sweet or the dessert that you remember at Christmas growing up? You think of something. If I say that sentence to people from Jordan, from Lebanon, from Saudi, from Egypt, from UAE, they all think of something else, but the same triggers the same emotion. So you need the journalist to package that 13 chocolate bars you remember growing up. That works in 200 countries, and it's a different article in every one.
So it's the psychology piece as well. You've understood the psychology of human nature.
You have to drive emotions.
How do you find these people? Because you've said journalist there, and actually caught my attention, because it's a totally different skill to what we classically would have known as journalism. I did a journalism master's, and it was really funny. I did it right at the end.
I'm sorry, we're good at this. Yeah, okay.
It's absolutely not.
Oh, well, I think so.
Absolutely zero to do with it. It's very funny. Like, nothing. Zero to do with it. Oh, because they taught you the old journalism print model.
They did, but they did something else. You finished the degree, and like, university, I think, has a lot to do with that. And what happened? We still hire journalists. But what we get is someone who has that O model, but they still are fact checkers, curious. They believe in the discipline. But what we do is we teach them how to curate. I teach them how to go onto Instagram places when there's a concert on to see the viral video of the stories the night before. Old people go to me, hey, Rich, we'll go down with a mic. No, we won't. We'll sit back here and we'll take from the 30,000 phones that are there. Stop thinking like you're important. You're not. Curate. And then once they have found the video, that juice, that exciting thing. Remember there was one like Steve Aoki was in Dubai and he shoved a cake in someone's face.
Remember that? Yeah.
We go get that. We go get that not by being there. We go get that because I train them to where to look, how to look, and then how to package, and then how to distribute in real time. That hook, that headline's important. Choosing that image on Canva, that emotion, that story, all that stuff.
That's really interesting, the curation.
And we only hire journalists, really. Like,
you still hire journalists, yeah, in the traditional sense.
Yeah, but journalists who want to be media personalities as such, as opposed to creators. Yeah, I still hire journalists. And I bring in interns from all the journalist universities for a month, for 3 months, score them, wait until they graduate and give them a job 2-3 years later. And then, but we chance everything. Like, I don't worry too much about hiring. If they have a good energy, a good attitude, you know the way some startup podcasts say, hire slow, fire fast. I don't. I hire fast, fire fast. I love that. I'm Blackburn Rovers fan, and Mark Hughes, when he was manager, he loves trialing players. What?
Niche.
Yeah.
Niche. You're the first Blackburn fan I've ever met.
Yeah, still can't get rid of them. They won yesterday. But like, I'm watching a lot of Saudi League these days. But anyway, so he would trial a player. He would put them in training for a few months. And I love that. I love that approach. And people, you know, we always pay interns, but people sort of look down an internship. But I like testing young people. I like putting people on camera early in their career. We have a 20-year-old here who we're helping through university because she's that good. You know, she's that good. She's so bloody talented. And I can see it. And like, sure, there'll be mistakes. And yes, I've had legal fees and we have loads of issues and stuff. But it's worth it.
It's the price of success, isn't it? There's like, find the cost of success and pay it. I find it interesting about the almost like a, it's kind of looked down on at home as well, as like people doing kind of like, you know, practical skills, like becoming a carpenter or a tradesman. You don't sit in a college for 4 years to become a carpenter. You do your apprenticeship. And I think a lot of businesses need to think like this, especially entrepreneurs. You need to think of like bringing people through apprenticeships, because you learn by doing. You don't become a good podcaster by reading the book about podcasting. You learn a podcast by doing it. That's the same with, definitely the same with journalism, because it's that thing, right? If you're listening, I'm doing that thing with my fingers again, where I'm just rubbing my fingers together. It's that feel. It's that touch. It's that muscle memory of what works. So you've built a serious business. We're sitting in your giant studio. Like, this is, seems relatively new, is it?
3 years, yeah. 12,000 square foot studio. We pay about, what's 600,000 dirhams, that much in rent a year, and it costs us $1 million for the fit out from free cash flow, $1 million.
$1 million?
Yeah. Oof. Yeah, and people will say, why build fancy studios when you can do production? And I get that, but you have to look at what happens after you do things. Does your revenue explode? Is the space, that, you know, can you think, can you hire more people? Does it do this? Does it create opportunities? And the answer is yes. So we had an event here for 200 clients on Friday. You probably see remnants of it. You know, we paid $20,000 just to host that event for a Ramadan event. But we had, you know, heads of marketing at Nestle, at Hilton, You know, we had all these people here. No small media companies doing this, but we want to be big. And we'll be 10 years this year. We'll do a big stunt for Love in Dubai and whatever. But, you know, so we invest in the studios. I'll do this in Egypt. I have studios in Riyadh. Rest of the place is kind of like co-working office space with studios. But gradually we'll grow. I believe content is manufacturing. I didn't hire a back office in Egypt or India. I hired journalists here, and I treated the unit economics about manufacturing within the UAE, because the UAE is a relatively large country and people think made in China or automotive parts in Germany. I manufactured content here, and I found the price point, a business model that kept that 20% margin, because I had to. I didn't have investment. I had a franchise. So I had to make money, and I had to have that bank balance every month. So I really, you know, from the Beirut experience and Mindshare, I saw the pros and cons of having a back office and content. It didn't really work. Now we do our tech in Egypt, but we keep the content here. And it allows me to have, like, one weekend, last weekend, we did 17 shoots across the UAE. I was saying off air before. We did 80 real shoots in each month in October, November, December. And because we hire young journalists, creators, and we have a client service team, and we book the clients. And, you know, so that's why we invested in the space and the studios and things like that. Are there mistakes? Maybe. Like, these studios aren't at capacity because it's in a TikTok era. But I'm okay with it because our revenue's growing and things like that. But, like, it allows us, you know, we look at to be the modern media company across the region, stick with digital. We don't buy radio licenses for the sake of it. Stick with digital, text, audio, and video, and build our own IP. And when you think of text, audio, and video, we have 35 podcasts, but they're not like yours. They're the Love in Dubai show every day, or the Love in Bahrain show, or the Love in Muscat show. Like, if you go on and you want to hear about Kuwait, you can go on the Love in Kuwait show, 10 minutes, one journalist, once a week. I will grow that. I now have 1.3 million downloads a month from Podcast Network.
Wow.
But without having one guest. We have guests, but without, that's not the format.
You're manufacturing.
Yeah, manufacturing. And the same with newsletters. We have 144,000 subscribers on newsletters, but it's not a core business. But I'm trying to build up that first party thing. And then with video, we have 250 social media channels. We have 50 on TikTok. You know, 22 on Lovin' and 13 on Smashy, plus a few English and Arabic double up. You know, so we manage all those Instagram accounts, and now we're big into AI as well.
How is AI changing?
Well, firstly, we use AI cameras, a bit like the same cameras League of Ireland use, but we use AI cameras to do futsal, volleyball, handball, and basketball to broadcast live sports on a Smashy TV app at like $5 a month subscription. So we replaced the OB truck. We're targeting the legacy incumbent TV stations, the RTEs of here, instead of going after Netflix and DAZN and that stuff. And we're using AI cameras for that. That's one. Two is software that everyone has access to. The big household names now, pretty much. ChatGPT, Sora, and all that, but a lot of others.
What are you using it for?
Captions, automated highlights, cloning voices, audio labs for podcasts. You can listen to a podcast today that we use AI for the script and we use AI for the voice, and you wouldn't know.
It's wild, isn't it?
And we're embracing it. I've set an internal target to get to 50% of our content by the end of the year to be facilitated by AI. I want to, all those cities that we don't have more content in, I want to do it. But I don't want to do it. Most AI content's crap, but it's moving so fast. I want to do it in a way where it's adding value, where it's doing it in a way that's good.
Yeah, you predicted my next question, because we talked about taste a lot and style. How do you do AI, but with the same style that you guys have? Because obviously you have a voice, you have a tone, you have that feel. How do you use AI without losing that?
It's getting there. I mean, you don't do it fully, like, but you're getting there. AI's getting there. Like, it really is. Now, ChatGPT and that stuff, no. And not everyone knows the level that we're talking about, like Midjourney, Sora, like all these other softwares. There's one called HeyGen, which does the cloning. Audio Labs is exploding. Audio Labs, I think, is it's a unicorn already. It's raised $250 million in a year. Like, there's all these softwares that are exploding. I invest personally in some of these softwares to keep an eye on it. But it's just that acceleration of AI. I don't want to be sitting here, Gary, and letting AI eat our lunch. I'm not afraid of it either. I might be afraid of AGI. I might be afraid of robots and that stuff, but for media, I'm not afraid of it. Like Walt Disney started as an animator, but made video color TV, right?
That's a good analogy.
When color TV came along, other people would have sold their animation stuff. When technology disrupts media, so we need to embrace AI, and we do it with investments. You know, I was so tight on software that I wouldn't let people get a Photoshop or a license extra or whatever. Now I opened up the credit card. I'm like, last year we trialed 30, 40 softwares, you know, way more than we would have ever spent on software. Mm. And I'm like, guys, just go with it. Just run.
It's very accessible now, though. Because you're talking about $20 a month. I remember buying Photoshop licenses $1,000. I was like, oh, it's a lot of money. Whereas now you can just like go, yeah, we'll try this for a month.
Yeah.
30-day free trial. Cool, let's try it.
Yeah, they add up though, but yeah.
They do. You know, if you're running a big business, they do. But like, I use it as well. Like I use like different things for captions, descriptions, just to speed it up. I look at it as like my digital assistant.
That's what it is.
I look at it and go, right, it doesn't replace me, but it speeds up my flow, my process. Like a lot of stuff you do in media is repetitive. You know, every time you're doing titles, tags, descriptions, you know, you're doing all that repetitive work. Whereas if you're aiding the talented journalist that you have, that's really interesting. The FTSE fund. What is that?
Well, it's nothing majorly legit. Like it's I started investing in media tech stuff in emerging markets. When I found a podcast platform in Lebanon, Podio, and I brought it to our board and I'm like, guys, I think we should invest in this. And they're like, that sounds like more a Rich thing like me than an Augustus thing. Like, cool, okay, I'm going to invest in it. And then it kind of went from there. And then basically what it's allowed me to do, Gary, is stay disciplined on the sort of profitable growth of Augustus without pivoting into tech. And
not getting distracted from the core.
Yeah. So I then grow Augustus as what it is. And I know the margins. And I never tell someone, hey, invest in VC in me. I'm going to make a SaaS for podcasts or a SaaS for newsletters. And then, but I know I need to scratch that itch. I know I see all this stuff. So I get dividends every year. And I put like, you know, $50K or $100K tickets into this stuff. And then I was like, okay, I have about 7 or 8 of them or whatever. And I set up FTSE Fund and I see it as a 10-year fund. And if I get return on that, I'll then hire a private equity person or a VC person. I'll sit them in Abu Dhabi and I'll try and raise money for the second fund. So I'll fund it maybe, I have an idea of like $1 million or so over 10 years. And like what, like say 7 or 8 of them, 3 of them are definitely failing. Like, you know, like 3 or 4, 1 or 2 might make it. And that's like, it's scary and hairy. Like I've just got married, I'm starting a family, like I need to do other investments, that sort of stuff. So like, but like angel investment, not for the faint of heart. Like it's not fun. It actually is fun, but it's not profitable. It's not smart.
Yeah.
And a lot of people.
And yet every founder wants to do it. Every single founder I talk to, I'll ask you the quick fire round now in a few minutes, but like every single founder, I'm like, I'm going to give you 10 million. And they're like, I'd like invest it in either my own business, which I'm like, cool, but apart from that, they're like, oh, I'd invest in startups. I'm like, what a degenerate answer. Because it is, it's what you know, though. There's definitely something there, this business model there for helping founders leverage exactly what you're doing. I was reading Dylan Collins' email and he was talking about there should be private wealth managers just for founders to help.
I agree. And you know what happens is when they have an exit, they then start investing.
But in other stuff they have no expertise in. Like, oh yeah, well, the classic, we'll open a pub or we'll open a coffee shop. And you're like, you know nothing about that.
Yeah.
Don't like, whereas like you have a lifetime of social media and media expertise. For you to go off and start investing in like an Irish bar makes no sense.
No. Well, I mean, yeah, it's not a portfolio, but you can build a family office in different ways. I agree, but I don't do it. But like I'm doing it inside with growing, you know, if I ever sell this or whatever, don't want to, or want to list it or I want to grow it. But like, it's also allows that sort of, that could become something itself.
Mm.
Like, let's see, like, you know, there's a few different softwares, a few different streaming services, a few different media companies there. And I keep looking at the creator economy. You know what, as a founder, like I might, you say I'm restless and stuff, like I might think, what would loving look like as if there was a dating element to it, if there was a matchmaking part in the app, would the app grow faster? Could we get subscription? Mm. But instead of doing that, I'm like, no, let's provide utility. Let's have fast social news there. We're building an AI writer to do more articles on loving as well. Inshallah, with the tool, with the tone and everything. But yeah, so it just allows that bit of discipline.
I think you need that, because otherwise you do exactly what you said there. You start becoming a bit of everything.
Yeah.
And whereas you know exactly what you are, or exactly what you're not.
And I know it takes time. I know my streaming bet on sports needs another 10 years. And I bought myself that time with our board by giving them dividends and not having to raise money.
Okay. So yeah, the Smashy is a separate app. That's just streaming service.
Yeah, I mean, well, basically, the Smashy has 13 verticals, Smashy Business, Smashy Sports. And for the user, it's a newsletter, a podcast, and social media. So it's just like Lovin. But instead of being an app and a website like Lovin Dubai, it's a streaming service as well. So I monetize on that, but I build community and audience, and I try and get sponsored content on Smashy Business. Like, Smashy Business is the media partner. Like, we'll be at Web Summit in Doha and Qatar on Sunday next week. I know this is timely, but like, yeah, basically, Smashy Business is the brand that goes to all the startup stuff. We did Leap in Saudi last week. We're at Sharjah Entrepreneurship Festival last week. We'll be at Step Conference Dubai and Rise Up. So we're at five in Egypt. We have five different, but I don't go there with Love in Dubai. I go there with Smashy Business. And Smashy Sports tries to tell what's happening in the Saudi league with Ronaldo and, you know, the latest stars and stuff like that.
It's so timely considering the focus that's on it now.
Huge,
like the elite set. What's, you've kind of half touched on it there, like you've covered a massive amount of ground in 2016 to 2025. What's the next couple of years look like for you? Like, what's your vision? Because you clearly have a very direct one.
I want to get to $25, $30 million by 2030-ish. We have a full plan on this. I think I can do it from the Gulf States. The economics of, I described the Middle East and North Africa a bit like, not in terms of size, but in terms of economy, like US and then LATAM. US is good economy, LATAM is a mixed bag. And the Gulf is flying. The Gulf, modern city states, don't underestimate them. The modern Gulf states, like, they're all a bit different, but like Abu Dhabi, Doha, Dubai, flying. And then the rest are figuring it out. Like Saudi is definitely interesting. Riyadh's amazing. Like, it's so exciting. It's completely different. The new metro's opened and the numbers are incredible. Like, it opens up the city. Jeddah's another one. We haven't opened an office in Jeddah yet. We will. I think I can get, without getting private equity and baby equity, I think I can get to $25, $30 million from these cities while growing Lovin in Iraq, Lovin in Cairo, Lovin in the Levant region, and then slowly dipping our toes risk style into North Africa, Chinez, Casablanca, Algiers, things like that. And then streaming. I think the market will heat up in 28 to 30 in streaming when more smart TV penetration comes here. I think I'll be in a position to buy more sports rights then. So that's the sort of goal. If we can get to there, we need to get to $100 million revenue. There are only a handful of media companies in the region, including the big tech firms, who do that and a billion. The guy who founded Morning Brew once said that, like, media is one of the easiest sectors in the world. Not easy, but one of the margins and the multiples are more than a coffee shop to get to over $10 million, whatever figures that is. But one of the hardest to get to 100. I think that's 7 and 8, is it? 7 or 8 or 8 and 9. Anyway, yeah, I should, anyway. So it's the hardest to get. You can get to 10, 12 like we have. It took 10 years. It wasn't easy. But to get to 100 million is super hard. And that's the goal.
What media brands you look at, like new media brands, and look at and go, they're smashing it?
Podcasts, because they're not media brands. Like Piers Morgan's Uncensored, what you're doing, Die of a CEO, they're smashing it. Like, you know, look at Spotify's top lists in the US, Huberman, Joe Rogan, they're all smashing it. Yeah. And then obviously the creator-led stuff, but I wouldn't really call them media brands. You know, the Logan Pauls and CSI, I don't really call them media brands. Like, they have media, they have YouTube revenue. But the hot thing this year is podcasts as video, as this sort of stuff. I think they're smashing it. I think they're replacing TV. Like, if you want to sell a book, you go on a podcast now. You don't go on the Late Late Show, you know? And that was different with Oprah 10 years ago.
How do you think, I'm going to get free advice here, how does that model evolve? Because that's what I'm thinking about every single day, every waking hour I'm awake. I'm like, how does this evolve? How does what I do evolve?
Business-wise or audience?
Both.
Business-wise, you either sign deals directly with the streaming services, or you find a way to get subscription, or you get bigger brand deals. So you're saying that Dublin isn't hasn't got podcast studios. You find some way in Dublin, whether it's the Mansion House or whatever, to pay you for a year, and or a developer, and they will be the number one thing. And then you sell your ads on top of it. So you do it direct. You keep building. You don't make t-shirts and hats and stuff. You can merch, but you do subscription, branded content, and then also CTV ad tech. The revenue that's going to come from podcasts and Spotify. Spotify did a headline recently that they gave out $10 billion in advertising to music. You're going to get some of that. The Sony Music are making 99% of their revenue from streaming services now. It's all flipped in 10 years. Wow. The musicians now are making money from Spotify. Podcasters are going to get that, and they're going to get it from Netflix. Netflix are building an ad platform. So it won't be just like, hey, pay. The rev share will be real like YouTube, but it'll be different. And then the other way is podcast networks. So Red Seat does all the right-wing stuff in the US. They just sold to Tubi. They do the Tucker Carlson and everything like that. So someone could approach Gary, someone legit or whatever, and go, hey, I'm never going to interfere with you, but I'm going to round up 10 podcasters in Dublin. I'm going to build the fanciest studios, and I'm going to make you grow on social. And then they will sell that business to someone in the future, and they will help you grow as well. Goalhanger.
I should do that myself. It's something I need to do myself.
You should. You should. Yes. Goalhanger does it. Gary Lineker's Goalhanger has the rest is politics, the rest is history. There's two media companies in the UK, Goalhanger and Tortoise Media. And Tortoise is a turtle is slow. So they do, the difference in what you do and what I do, you do slow news, I do fast news. You drop an episode each week, it's highly produced, high quality, and there's a business in it, absolutely. It's Diary of a CEO. The other trick that Diary of a CEO does, he'll do a 3-minute, the podcast is a feed, podcast like social media. The app is different to Netflix, if you think about it. When you go on Netflix and they drop in a new show, it's always the earliest episode first, next, second, third, because that's how we watch TV shows. Podcasts is different. That's why serials never worked on. Some did, but they don't really work because the latest episode's the last one, it's the end. So no one built a podcast like Netflix. And even Spotify are going to have this problem. Like Spotify is built like Apple feed, the latest at the top, flip it. You know, I tried to invest in some podcast apps like that who went to Disney. Disney don't want to do deals with Apple because they want to do, Indiana Jones as a 12-part podcast, highly produced, but they need an app, and Netflix is the app, you know? Right. They need a place where it's audio. You know, audio production? Yeah. Like, and Audible is really good. Like, I listened to 1984 as an Audible, and it's done by, I think the guy from, I don't know, I think it's the guy from one of the famous English actor, and it's a brilliantly audio produced, you know, so there's value in that. But like, what's the app? Where does it live? What's the business model?
Yeah, I think audio discovery and podcast discovery in general is poor. I think that's why I think going video first is, it's just been a game changer for so many. Quick fire round.
Okay.
What book should every entrepreneur read?
Oh, there's so many cliches on these ones. Yeah, I know you referenced 0 to 1 and that. Like, I've read them all. And it's funny, I do rating review. Can I answer long on this?
Okay. Go for it.
So on Goodreads, I do a review.
We'll clip it. Say what the book is.
But I do Goodreads. I'll tell you what my strategy is. I read 20 to 30 books a year on Audible for the last 6 or 7 years. And knowledge compounds, and I find it such a brilliant trick, and I do it while I do triathlon training, and I rate them all on Goodreads app, and I have 3 categories of books that I read and go and rotate. One is the startup founder book, 2 is a business book, an entrepreneur book, which is different, I'll tell you why, and 3 is a Middle Eastern book, politics or history. I'm finishing a book about World War I at the moment and Syria, and it's so fascinating. There was a with what's happening right now. Alistair Campbell did a podcast with Ahmed al-Shara in Damascus last week, and they're talking about writing a new constitution. They wrote one, and the French got rid of it. They wrote one 100 years ago, and the French kept it till 1975 and then disposed of it. They have a liberal constitution. Fascinating. Anyway, so that's the Middle Eastern book. The startup books are 10 a penny. Principles, like all these books are really good, 0 to 1. They're all really good. I like them all, like How to Win Friends, Influence People, 5 a.m. Clubs, not as good as the Atomic Habits, bloody excellent.
It's the most, I talk about this all the time. Like I literally should have, James Clear should be giving me profit share. I talk about it almost on every single episode.
I think you're religious.
It's very good. But the books I like are the autobiographies. It goes back to when I read... the one, William Randall Hearst, and then the one about the Daily Mail guy in Ireland. He's actually a Brit guy 100 years ago. Those are the two best books for me.
Perfect.
And also, obviously, Ride of a Lifetime, These Are Clichés, and Shoe Dog. Yeah.
Shoe Dog, most recommended. Yeah. By a mile. What's something you'd learn the hard way?
In this business story, definitely working with authorities and legal and stuff like that. I learned it the hard way. My passport was taken for 18 months, public prosecutor, linked to a person known in the Ireland world, but I'll leave it at that. Articles around that sort of stuff, I learned it the hard way. Yeah, it cost me a bit of money too.
So you were stuck here for 18 months?
Yeah, technically, we were able to swap passports, but I was basically in a bit of a conundrum for a while.
Wow. You have to tell me about that off air. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I wouldn't call it, the word would be sacrifice, but I put everything else on hold for this. Like I lived life like a monk. Like I gave up friends. I kind of not resounded to not getting married, but I kind of decided that this would be okay. I was content from about up until last year, up until 2 years ago, from 2015 to 2023. And I still like, I just sacrificed a lot. Like I just sort of, but I found myself through that. I found that sort of zone. I found that sort of knowledge compounding, fitness, discipline, control, emotional intelligence. I found all that sort of stuff through this.
I think we're going to have to do a second pod because there's so much I wanted to ask you about. Like I do business, body, brain. Didn't we get to brain or body yet? What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
To put it across my portfolio, I'd invest it across what I'm doing. I have some property, I have some crypto, I have some ETFs, I have some bonds, I have some I have some equities, I have FTSE fund and property. I just put it across the portfolio. I've read all the portfolio books, the Good Weather, Bad Weather, Robins and stuff like that. So I just put it across the portfolio. I'd probably push it a little bit, I'd parse some of FTSE fund. Would I put it into this business? Probably not. I think we can get debt if we need to. We've had debt before. Would I buy it on one particular thing? Maybe not. I'd do that. I've learned about investment and it's so funny, like the amount of people, especially they call us expats over here and they're like, hey, when are you going to move back home? What? You mean, when am I going to drive home this afternoon? What? So like that sort of stuff. They just ask me all the stuff that my head's not comprehending. So anyway, I learned investment myself. So I'm not brilliant at it, but I will continue to do that.
Okay. I'm going to give you 1 million euro to invest in one person or one company, not yourself.
Latest one I invested in was one called Bith.ai. It's a Palestinian Jordanian guy in Amman. And Amman's Bith, B-I-T-H, Arabic word for broadcasting. It's video software. It's like V.io. It's like a lot of these video AI highlights. If anyone's listening, like it's super cheap. It's $10 a month. It gets all this stuff that other people would charge you $20, $30. So I really like what he's doing. And I've made failures. I've invested in a competitor to OpenSea, Nifty Souk, because the two founders had done it before. They were in their 40s. I'm like, that's going to work. They've had 5 failures, but they came from the venture studio idea and they just flipped at the first sign of trouble.
Yeah.
So they just pivoted. So I like this guy, Omar Dwaik. I like what he's doing. Jordan's full of developers. A lot of the good stuff has come out of there. So I really like this one, Bit.io.
Okay. If you're starting again in 2025, what business would you build?
Same one. This is isn't perfect. It's been hard, but I know how to run it. I don't know how to run anything else. I'm not good at raising money. I'm not good at telling people something that's not going to happen. So I would build the same one. I'm happy with what we built. Build the same one, Augustus Media.
What do you believe other people will find weird or strongly disagree with?
I think I've probably said some of it in terms of media and rules in the region. Well, give me a clue. Like, what else would I say on that? Like, I genuinely believe that the global South is the new superpower. I really think that the American empire is dying. If you read books from early 20th century, like 1905, the newspapers used to not know who's going to be big at the end of the century, because the Brits were big back then. They didn't really know. Like America, a couple of markets in America only happened over time. Like it wasn't big. Like America was youngish back then. And I think they underestimate what's happening at the moment. I think they underestimate it. I think they underestimate the Middle East. I think they underestimate MBS. I think they throw shade at these neon projects. I think they underestimate Indonesia, Singapore, China. I think they underestimate the Middle East. And I really think that, you know, I'm thinking global south. Like I'm not going back to Europe or Ireland or America. I don't invest there. I don't look there. You know, and India is underestimated for how big its stock market is. They've got two stock exchanges and no one talks about it. When Modi was with Trump, they were just laughing at translating English Indian into English. It's just, you know, there's just a global racism problem, you know, anti-Semitic, Islamophobia. It's just a global issue. And I think they're going to get their comeuppance. Like if you're literally, as you know, Irish people felt it for years, right? Like this English approach, this sort of cockiness and stuff. And Americans are going to get hit. They're going to get hurt.
Well, it's all coming home to roost right now. I think if you look at the UK and you look at the US, formerly superpowers, and they're kind of going, oh, totally rushing to go to either of those two places, right?
Right. And that, Gary, when you and I grow up, I'm assuming we're in the same sort of like 1980s or whatever.
Like, well, oh, America or London. Whereas that's why I'm here. I'm here to learn. I'm here to understand, is this the new future? And like I'm here, what, just under a week now. It feels like it is.
I'm telling you it is. Like, and when I moved to Dubai in 2012, my bosses were like, why are you going here? 2 million people. Dubai already is going to be 4 million people. UAE is going from 8 or 9 to 11 or 12. It's mad. And then the Middle East, North Africa is 340 million people, 350 million people. So you can see I'm 13 years here and I'm not bored.
Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global.
What's been your worst investment?
Probably that Nifty Sook thing is a bad investment. But to be fair to them, they tried, they're nice guys. But I've made a few poor startup investments on that level. Some stocks, like I invest in BuzzFeed to learn. I intend their quarterly shares and stuff, but I didn't lose a ton, but they're just bad investments. Some of the stuff that I've done here, like I bought some stuff that hasn't paid off, it's taken longer. You know, I did Arabic streaming OTT linear with Smashy at the start, and it took a while to get that right. Luckily, we were making a lot of money on Snapchat shows. So my board weren't questioning Smashy revenue, but like some of the stuff I did early on streaming, I probably went too away from what we were doing on Lovin' too early on some of those decisions and things like that. I didn't go all in. So I was able to like pivot and tweak and stay long-term.
That's why I call it the entrepreneur experiment, because I believe that's what business is.
Yeah.
The best entrepreneurs I know are like calculated risk takers. They do a little test here, test here, test here, test here, and keep testing. What's been your best investment?
Cliche like Warren Buffett, like invest in yourself. But I think, you know, going back to those 7 days assets, that Lovin' franchise thing, we'd already built a business, but like those type of things were such good deals, like unbelievable deals. When I look at like price and value and what we get out of it in the future, unbelievable deals. Like I like Podio. I like that. Like they just done a $5.4 million Series A, a podcast platform, like hosting. What do you use to host this?
Lipson.
So a bit like that for the Arab world. Like I think that's a good one. Like, you know, I put 100k in, it's on paper worth 600 or 700k now, but like nowhere near, like the business model isn't perfect and stuff like that. So those type of stuff I like. I've invested okay on some shares. I bought my goddaughter one Tesla share for $250, and now it's 1/4 because it did that split then. But I did that like 10 years, I think she's 8, yeah, on her birthday, and that was a good investment for her.
Well, that's brilliant. I love stories like that. What's your final piece of advice to every entrepreneur listening or aspiring entrepreneur listening?
Like, come to Middle East, come to Dubai, go to Saudi, go to Riyadh.
Is Saudi the new spot?
Yeah. It's not the new Dubai. You will have to think Arab. You will have to, it's an Arab world, and it's not Dubai. And if you want the not the trappings, but if you're a little bit mercenary, if you're a little bit like that Dubai bling style, then it's not for you. But as well as like Web3 and AI, like if there's a time, I would go to Riyadh. I like that I spent my 20s in Dublin and London. I love the crack I had. I love that I got that kind of out of my system. I love the fun. But from 28 to say 42 now, or soon, I love the Middle East. And you know, things for everyone, depends on what age they're at. But Riyadh's on one. I was just at Leap last week. Like in 3 years, 4 years, they built CES Southwest Southwest in one. Like
Leap.
Yeah, 200,000 people. Unbelievable.
Tech, business, both.
Yeah. The startup, like Web Summit. Okay. But bigger.
Okay, I'm gonna have to check that out. Richard, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ari.
An unbelievable chat.
Good man. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on. And good luck in your trip. Fair play to you for coming out here.
Thanks so much.